So the topic you discussed actually fascinated me quite a bit, because it's not an idea that I heard before. But as I started learning more and more, I realized that this idea is actually present in Torah sources from hundreds of years ago. So I want to share this idea, because the idea, potentially, if you really think about it and you take it seriously, is potentially life transformative. It's really a very powerful idea, and I hope you guys give it a chance. And then hopefully after we go through some of the makoros and some of the ideas, I want to show you a short clip that captures a part of this idea very beautifully. I want to start with an idea that some of you have heard before. We know that on Sukkot we take four different plants, if you wish. What are they? Four different things. What are they? What are the four?
Etrog.
A lulav and etrog that we generally know. By the way, how do you say etrog in English?
Etrog.
Citron, yeah. And what are hadasim? How do you say it in English? What are hadasim in English?
Leaves.
Leaves. Hadasim are in English called myrtle. And aravot are what? Well, that's the title of this class. Aravot are willow branches, the willow tree. So the Midrash asks, why do we take these four? And it offers a very interesting answer. It actually offers a number of answers, but there's one that interests me now. Just we're going to read part of it inside and part of it we're going to say out. Priyat Hadar, Elu Yisrael. The citron, the etrog, represent the Jewish people. My etrog, yesh bo tam, yesh bo reach. It smells very, very nice. I don't know if you smelled this before. It smells very nicely. And it has a nice, a very pleasant taste, especially if you know how to cook it well. It has a pleasant taste. Kach Yisrael, yesh behem bnei adam, sheyesh behem Torah. There are people who are filled with wisdom and they're filled with good deeds. What about tamarim? What do tamarim represent? El Yisrael, ma hat tamra hazo yesh batam ve'in bariach. If you ever had a date, okay, if you ever eaten a date, it tastes very sweet. It's very, very delicious. My doctor said I have to be on a diet. I'm staying away from the cookies. No ragalach for me. No soda. But at home I have dates. Dates I can eat. Okay, so dates taste very good. They don't particularly have a smell. What about a myrtle? Oh, so by this, so what do the tamarim represent? They represent Jews who have Torah, but don't have a lot of masim tovim. So taste represents Torah, smell represents masim tovim. That gets us to the third category, a myrtle. What does a myrtle have? What does a myrtle have? Does it have a taste? Anyone ever eaten a myrtle? Eaten hadassim? Has no taste. But it has a very pleasant smell. That represents Jews who have good deeds, but don't have a lot of wisdom. And finally, a willow. What does a willow have? Nothing. Doesn't taste good. Doesn't smell good. And the Midrash says that represents the Jews, Shein Bahem, Lo Torah, Velo Masim Tovim. Nothing. They have no wisdom. They don't really do much that's good. So then the Midrash continues in a little bit of a puzzling way, and that's what I'd like to ask two questions on. This is this, in the Midrash, in the second to last line, if you guys want to follow. Umah HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Oseh Lahem. What does God do with those Jews who don't do a lot of good deeds, don't really have a lot of Torah? What should God do with them? La'avdan yifshar. God can't get rid of them. God, for some reason, can't get rid of them. Elam HaKadosh Baruch Hu, yukshiru kulam aguda achat. Let's put them all together into one bundle. The etrog, the hadasim, the aravot, the lulav. Vehen mechaprim elo al elo. And somehow, these are going to bring kapara to those. Okay, so somehow by bringing the willow tree with everyone else, somehow it gets redeemed. So I have two questions. Number one, well, why cannot God get rid of them? Meaning, if they don't do anything, they don't have any wisdom, so it's impossible to get rid of them. Why? That's my question number one. Question number two, how does bringing them together with everyone else redeem them? That's my two questions. Now, since I'm Jewish, I'm going to answer a question with a question. Okay. The next source says the following. Omer Rabbi Abba, Amru Malachei Asharet Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The angels come to God and they say, Ribono Shel Olam, Mipnei Ma Ein Yisrael Amrim Shira Lefanecha. Why don't Jews say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? It's weird, right? On all of the Chagim we say Hallel, but on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur we don't. Why? Omer Lahem, so he answers them. Can't be. Avshar Melech Yoshev L'Kisei Din V'Sifrei Chayim V'Sifrei Meitim P'tuchim Lefanav Yisrael Amrim Shira. Can't be. God is sitting and judging. And he's got two books open in front of him. One book is the book of the living, people who are alive. And the other book is the book of the dead, people who are dead. God is judging both of them. It's such an awesome time, the Jews don't dare to say Hallel. I'm not going to enter right now the question, why can't the Jews say Hallel? But I actually have a different question. And that is, I understand why God has the book of the living open, because we are the living. We did something, we helped people today, or maybe we were mean to people, maybe we spoke Lashon Hara, maybe we davened, maybe we didn't daven. So God has to judge us. Why does God judge the dead? They didn't do anything. They're dead. They have no b'chira. They don't. So why in the world would we open the book of the dead? That's my third question. I have one more question for you. Which tefillah is associated with the dead? The tefillah, we think about the tefillah that we are often associated with memory for the dead or something like that. Which tefillah is that? Kaddish, right. By the way, does Kaddish mention anything about the dead? Nothing. What does it talk about? It talks about Hashem and Kiddush Hashem. Okay. Why do we say Kaddish for the dead? If it has nothing to do with the dead, it has to be Kiddush Hashem. Why do we say it? Anyone know the source for that? Okay, if somebody does, I'm very impressed, because most people don't. I brought here a source. I'm not going to read it inside just for the sake of time. This is a source why we say Kaddish for the dead. And the story goes like this. One of the Tanaim, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, is walking on the road, all by himself, contemplating whatever he's contemplating. All of a sudden, he sees a guy on the side of the road collecting wood. He comes up to him and greets him, and the guy gives him a little smile and says, "It's not what you think." Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai says, "What do you mean?" He says, "You're sleeping. You're dreaming. This is not really happening. This is a dream. And I'm dead. I'm dead. And I was such a terrible Rasha in my lifetime that I was sent to Gehenna. And my punishment is every single day to gather wood." And it's all happening in a dream. "It's to gather wood, and that wood is used to burn my body, and every day I have to start from scratch. But Rabbi," he says, "you can do me a favor. I left a pregnant wife in a certain village, and now the child was born and it's a boy. Please, I beg you, you can help me. I want you to go to that village and teach the son to say Baruch Hu." Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai wakes up from this very strange dream, which was very vivid, and he took it seriously, and he goes to the village, and lo and behold, he finds this woman with a little child. So he says, "Come here, little Angela," whatever this Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, he didn't know Yiddish obviously, but he teaches him how to say Baruch Hu, teaches him how to daven. A year later, he goes to sleep and has a dream, and this man comes to him and says, "Rabbi, thank you so much. You helped me tremendously." Now, this is a source for teaching or having saying Kaddish or some kind of Kiddush Hashem for the sake of helping the dead. Now, from that, we have other principles like taking mitzvahs for the memory of the dead or doing things for Le'ilu Nishmatam. I have a terrible problem with this story and all of those institutions. And my problem begins in the year 10,099 of the Common Era. What happens in the year 10,099? Anybody? A little European history. In the year 10,099, the Pope, Pope Urban II, if my history is right, issues a papal bull, which means that it's a document that it's a certain edict of the Pope calling people to do what? What does he want people to do? He calls upon people of Europe in his Christendom to do what? He calls them to go up to the on the Crusades to conquer, in European history, to conquer the land of Israel. Okay, the Muslims have defiled it; they have conquered it. So he wants all these Europeans to travel weeks upon weeks in this very hazardous journey to conquer the Holy Land from the Muslims. And thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, get up and they go. What do you think motivated them to go? Why did they go? What pushed them to go? Remember from history? Well, lots of different reasons. Some of them were religious people. They listened to the Pope, right? Some people were prisoners. This is a good way to get their freedom. Other people realized that what greases the wheels of the world, right? Money. They could get a lot of money by going. All of these factors are true, and all kinds of political factors. Generally, whenever something happens in history, it's not because of one reason or another. Usually, there's a combination of factors. But there's one more factor that was incredibly important, and that is the concept of indulgences. You guys know what indulgences are? So in the Catholic doctrine, oversimplifying this, when a righteous person goes to heaven, and he needs a certain number of good acts to get in, okay? What happens if he did extra credit? There's some extra deeds that are not necessary for him to enter heaven. Where do they go? So according to this doctrine, they fall back down to earth and are handed over to the church. And the church can choose to give these good deeds of these incredibly righteous people to those who need them. Obviously, in exchange for some service. Now, a person had committed a grave sin, whatever the sin is, and there's, you know, they don't want eternal damnation. So it was worthwhile to go to the church, to do what the church asked you to do, and buy, essentially, these good deeds. Wouldn't you want great deeds of some saint or some righteous person? That could really, you know, catapult you out of a very, very hot spot. Okay? So this is a concept of indulgence. It is a non-Jewish idea. I'd like to show you. There's an interesting tshuva.
If I can just have a volunteer, someone, you don't have to tell me this, someone did in the last maybe 2 weeks a really great mitzvah, like really something. Or maybe, you know what, forget the last few weeks. Think about maybe the best mitzvah you've ever done in your life. Okay, the best mitzvah, like really most, something you really had to sacrifice, you really did something really, really great. Okay? Can just, you don't have to tell me what it is. Can just, I need a volunteer. Okay, what's your name?
Ronnie,
what?
Ronnie.
I borrowed a book from someone. If you accidentally left $100 in the book, okay? But let's say the $100 would be mine. Let's say I work it out. I have $100 in the book. You sell me the mitzvah? You sell me the mitzvah for $100. I want that mitzvah. I want you to sell it to me. Yeah? $200? $300?
Okay. Any price at all? You would sell it for something? No, you wouldn't? Let's do it a little differently.
You know, there's one or two things in life I did that was really terrible. It was a chayk, an adir, I really feel it's going to be pretty bad for me, you know. I'll give you this $100 and I'll send it to you. It will go to you. You take it?
$100.
Anything bad for the bed?
What?
Toys.
Oh, yeah, it was embarrassing. You know, I was a teenager. You know how it goes. But I mean, maybe I'll tell you what it is, you know. $100, you'll take it?
No.
You won't take it. Well, there's a tshuva of the Maharam of Alshikar, and the tshuva discusses this very question. You know, it's funny, you think of a tshuva's deal with like chickens and like monetary matters. He deals with this question. The question is, can you buy and sell your averot and skuyot? So if you look at the fourth line from the bottom of that tshuva, a really fascinating tshuva, it's a tshuva written about 500 years ago or so. Gavarim elu divrei hevel, it's idiocy, stupidity, to buy and sell mitzvot. You don't rely on them. How can you think you can sell a good deed from one person to the other? It's an explicit verse. Everything we do good that goes to us, we can't sell it and buy it. So my fourth question is, how can we ever do anything good and give it to another person? We don't believe in that. Every person gets credit for their actions. So how can I say Kaddish for someone? How can I do a mitzvah for someone and email it to Olam Haba? It doesn't work that way in Judaism. That's my first question. Okay? I'd like to answer these questions. Look at the next page. I want to tell you about the next source. It's a sefer called Tzavazirus. There was a Rebbe whose name is Kalman Shapiro, who was a great Rebbe in pre-war Europe. He was known as a Rebbe Piasetzna. Piasetzna was a town outside of Warsaw. He was a great, great Torah scholar and a great Rebbe. When the war came, he was sent to the Warsaw Ghetto. He's also known as the Eish Kodesh. And all news ceased. He had a brother. He had some Hasidim in Eretz Israel. All news were lost. They didn't know who he was. And they gathered, since after the war, he didn't really contact anyone, that he was gone. They knew that he had in manuscript a number of Sfarim that he wanted to print. Okay? But they were gone. They didn't know where they were. So they went to the Jewish agency and they met a man, maybe you've heard of this man before, by the name of Baruch Duvduvani. Okay? Baruch Duvduvani. Baruch Duvduvani worked for the Jewish agency. So they said, Mr. Duvduvani, you go to Poland, can you help us find the writings of the Assessor Rebbe? And he said, you find in Poland writings of a person. But he said he was going to try. What had happened a little bit before is that as they were clearing out the Warsaw Ghetto, there was a worker who was shoveling out the rubble, and his shovel hit something metal. He pulled out with his hands a milk carton, milk container that he used to kind of carry milk in. He opened it up, and there were stacks of many, many papers, and in a language he didn't understand. So he passed it on and ended up in a Jewish museum, where Baruch Du Devani eventually found the writings of the Piasetz, the Rebbe, and one of the pages actually used as evidence in the Nuremberg trial against the Nazis. One of the books that were in manuscript form that was printed is a sefer called Tzav HaZirus. Tzav HaZirus was the Rebbe's spiritual journal. I don't know if you guys keep a journal. Maybe you guys think it's a girly thing to do. But the Rebbe kept a journal of his personal spiritual journey. And in the very first entry in that journal, he wrote a very, very powerful idea that's going to help us answer some of our questions. And he wrote the following. He said, you know, I spend my life working with myself. And there's trial and error, and things work and things don't work. And the problem is, at some point, you run out of time. Time is a very special component of our lives, and we don't have an infinite number of it, an infinite amount of it. So therefore, we at some point we run out. Wouldn't it be amazing, says the Rebbe, if you can live out your life, make all your mistakes, all the trial and errors, and you can come back a second life with the wisdom of the first life. That's what he says. It's about we don't have such a chance. So what should we do? And the Rebbe here develops an incredibly powerful idea. And he says the following. When we influence others, when we help others, when we do kindness for other people, when we teach them, when we give them a way to approach life, we continue to live on within the lives of those people. And even after we die, we live on through our students, through our children, and through all those people whom we helped. And it's a very interesting thing, because this idea is found actually in the Malbim. There's a pasuk on page 2. It's a pasuk from Mishlei that I think you're familiar with. The pasuk says, Tama kitov sachra, lo yigbe balay lo neira. Anyone familiar with that pasuk? You guys sing Esh Yischayel? No one sing here Esh Yischayel? Okay. Like on Shabbos, after Shalom Aleichem? So that's a pasuk, Tama kitov sachra, lo yigbe balay lo neira, which is talking about the Esh Yischayel, this woman of valor. The pasuk means she's very good in business, and her candle never goes out at night. Now, just in terms of simple reading of the pasuk, why does her candle not go out at night? She's what?
It's a big candle.
It's a big candle. Okay, good. It's a big candle. What does that have to do with the first part of the pasuk? She's very good in business. Her candle doesn't go out at night.
Humble.
Humble. Okay. What else? What else could it be?
Honest.
Bright. Okay. I thought that the symbol in the pasuk is that because she works hard. She works hard. Isn't the expression English to burn the midnight oil? Okay, that's the simple reading of the pasuk. We all know that Mishle is an allegory. It's a parable. Says the Malbim, you know what the Mashal here is? The Mashal here is that the Esh Yischayel represents all of us. It represents our neshamas. If we engage in the business, what's the business, says the Malbim? Not only to help ourselves. You know, what's a good businessman? Doesn't only do work for themselves. They get other people to do work for them. So the business of this Esh Yischayel is that she impacts other people. And even after the night comes, what do you think the Moshe of the night is? When she faces death. Because she has influenced others, her candle will burn forever. Now if you look at the next source, in the Shuri Das, he summarizes it very beautifully. When we influence other people in Torah, the Chokhmah, the Emunah, the Dat, when we teach others, we inspire others. Rucho chai bahem. Our life lives within them. Our ruach lives within them. You see, now we can take this idea, we can answer all of our questions. Let's answer the four questions that we had. We said, what's the reason why we do things for the dead? How is it possible we do anything? How can we, since we don't believe that you can email anything to the dead, so why do we do anything for the dead? You know how it works? The mechanism is not that we do something, give it to them. But the fact that someone influences us to do something good, they get credit for that. Imagine we see that there's a little girl, Chas V'Shalom, who's sick. And we decide to say Tehillim for her. And we take something upon ourselves. We don't know who she is. She doesn't know who we are. But the fact that she inspired us to do something great, is to her credit. And the chiddush here is, when that terrible Rasha who left his pregnant wife, the fact that he was a factor to bring this child into the world who's doing something good, that is to his credit, and that allows him to redeem himself. We asked why the Book of the Dead are opened up, and the answer is very simple, because after every single person in this room is going to go on to the next world, the actions that we leave behind, we will be judged on them forever. Whether it's good things that we leave behind, because you teach someone, you inspire someone, you put someone down, you embarrass them, there are consequences to those actions. There may be consequences for the rest of your life, the rest of that person's life, or maybe the consequences for the rest of someone else's life. I'll tell you something. I was once having a conversation with my daughter, who's maybe 6 years old. And she said to me, "Abba, is it true that some Abbas hit their children?" I said, "It's true." She said, "Is it true that they hit them very, very hard?" I said, "Yes, that sometimes happens." And I said, and she said to me, "Why do they do that?" I said, "You know, I don't know. But maybe it's because of their Abbas used to hit them very hard." So she thought about it. She said, "Well, why did their Abbas hit them hard?" I said, "I don't know, because maybe their Abbas hit them hard." So she stops and she, you know, her little mind started thinking about what that may mean, you know, trying to trace it kind of back and back and back. Sometimes our consequences, our actions have consequences for generations. We sometimes start something that may keep going for years and generations to come. And we have to answer for that. But at the same time, the good part of that is that sometimes we do something good and we change someone's life and their children's life forever. It's an incredible power that we have. That, by the way, answers the questions about the willow. The willow tree, the guy seems to be useless. He's not all that wise. He doesn't really do very much. But the moment you put everyone together, they redeem each other. Because sometimes the simplest person who has very little wisdom, who has little good deeds, can sometimes change a life of an individual forever. And what I want to do right now, in the next 3 minutes, I want to show you a clip of how a small little action by a small person can change a life of destiny of many. Okay, I'm going to show it to you on two computers. Now you probably wonder why I showed them. Because one computer shows the video well, and the other one has better sound. So you guys don't think that you're completely against technology. Technology in space. By the way, this movie is from Thailand, and it has subtitles, so just right away, it's just follow the subtitles. Okay, let's see. You guys see it? Can you close that a little bit more? Okay. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Think about that for a second, guys, this video. Very, very short clip. A small act of kindness. I would imagine the magnitude that we do all the time we don't even think about, or maybe we pass by without thinking about. But that's exactly, there's a medrash over here. The medrash tells us that, I don't have time, just for the sake of time, I have to do it. When a person does a mitzvah, says a medrash, you should do it with all of your strength. Because you have no idea, says a medrash, the impact of your action. And I think the idea here is so incredibly powerful. How every single person, they may be an Esther, or they may be an Arava, they may not have a lot of wisdom, may not think that we're all that great, but even the smallest people can make the biggest difference in other people's lives. And if we live that, and we think about that, and we take the opportunities to do those little things, we have no idea about how powerful the impact may be. And I believe that's one of the lessons of the Arava. Thank you so much, and Baruch Hashem.